Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Grand Canyon University President Brian Mueller held a news conference today and seemed to surprise attendees with the direction it went. GCU had been working for the past year and a half to go from for-profit to nonprofit, but that effort has been officially rejected by the Higher Learning Commission. With more details on that, I'm joined by KJZZ West Valley reporter Matthew Casey. Matt, did Brian Mueller explain what happened, why they got rejected?
Mueller was not exactly sure what exactly happened. He said there may have been some confusion or some misunderstanding about the university's intentions. He says that when HLC visited the campus, that went really well, and he had a lot of praise for that process. But something happened, he's not sure what, between the visit and when the HLC Board of Trustees voted last month. He says the board ended up having the impression that the school's academic work would be done under the umbrella of the for-profit service company. Mueller says that's not true, and it would be conducted by the deans and the faculty of the university.
This was the potential for a new era that could have been tremendously beneficial. It would have allowed us to keep investing and to keep freezing tuition and making this affordable.
Now, Matt, what have Mueller and the university said about their biggest hurdle of being a for-profit?
Well, the biggest hurdle is the perception that comes with that. Mueller said today that they've actually invested more into the campus than they've made in after-tax profits. There's construction going on all over campus. It was originally 100 acres. Now it's 250. They want to get to 400 acres. Right now on campus students, there's about 15,500, and they plan to go to 25,000 in the next 5 years.
You know, one of the criticisms of Grand Canyon has been, well, if you have investors, you will always care more about your investors than you do your students. There's absolutely no evidence to indicate any of that.
So, Matt, now that they've been rejected by the Higher Learning Commission, what are the possible next steps for GCU?
Mueller says they will find a way forward, but when asked for specifics about that, he declined to give them. He said he was still in the process of digesting what has happened. Of course, they can choose to remain a for-profit if they like, and HLC says that they can reapply to become a nonprofit again starting in the fall.
KJZZ West Valley reporter Matthew Casey with the latest on Grand Canyon University. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
In a statement the Higher Learning Commission issued today, it made clear the decision rejecting GCU's proposal to return to nonprofit status did not change the university's accredited status. So what exactly did the HLC's decision mean? To learn more, I'm joined by Eric Kelderman, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, what made this process different and more complex?
Grand Canyon was not seeking its regular reaffirmation of accreditation. It was going through what might be called a substantive change. So when a college makes a big change in how it's going to operate, whether it's a change of ownership or whether it's adding a branch campus or something like that, it has to go to the accreditor and get permission to do that, to make sure that, that new venture, that new entity or whatever it's going to be, still follows the accreditor's rules. And by the way, embedded within the accreditor's rules are lots and lots of federal rules as well. So the federal government relies on accreditors to make sure that everything's on the up and up. And the accreditor today said that the application to make that change had not met its criteria. Now, it used some very vague language, which is unfortunately typical for accreditors, and it talked about sort of the corporate structure, the corporate service structure shouldn't be separate from the corporate learning structure.
Was there any reason to think that there was something that the HLC just didn't, that there was a perception about Grand Canyon or about for-profits that, I don't know, makes the HLC or some of its people they sent out kind of uncomfortable?
So there may have been some skepticism on the commission's part about that. There was a report recently by the Century Foundation that described some of the motivations and some of the mechanisms by which this has been happening. So, and to be honest, accreditors have been under a lot of pressure lately from the Education Department, from the White House, to take a more rigorous view of all institutions, but in particular the for-profits.
Are there certain things that the GCU can obviously change about their proposal? Are there certain things that Brian Mueller is prepared to change? Did he give you any indication as to whether he'd want to jump back into this soon?
probably more reassuringly for the Higher Learning Commission, they at this point are not planning to file any legal action against the accreditor. Now, sometimes that happens as well, and then things get mired in the courts for a while. But I think they're going to sort of stand pat, so to speak, and move forward without trying to pursue this any further.
Are these the types of things that sort of ebb and flow? Could if a Republican is in the White House, you know, next year, is it possible that Grand Canyon would have a better chance?
I think at this particular point in time, the general sense is, I think, among elected officials on both sides, that they would like to see accreditors take a tougher stance, laying down maybe brighter lines about what it is that colleges have to show to prove that they're providing a quality education. But in general, I would say both parties have come down pretty hard on accreditation in recent months. And I think the focus that may or may not change depending on who's in the White House is whether the stance, the very heavy hand that the administration has placed on for-profit institutions continues or not. If there's a Republican in the White House, I think, and Republicans remain in control of Congress, that some of the pressure on for-profit institutions may dissipate.
Eric Kelderman is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
It was another eventful week at the state capitol, with lawmakers debating bills dealing with guns, abortion, and health care, among many other issues. Joining me to recap the week that was at the capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, let's start with guns. What was the legislature talking about on that front?
Well, of course, you know, it wouldn't be a week at the legislature if we didn't discuss gun rights. The obvious big bill in all of this deals with the question of guns in public buildings. Right now, if you want to bring your gun over into, let's say, City Hall, and there's no metal detector there, there's a little sign on the door that says no guns, and you're supposed to say, of course, I don't want to have a gun, and I'll, and as long as there's a locker to check it, they can tell you don't bring the gun. Well, the argument is, and there's some merit to it, is that criminals don't obey signs. So this bill is designed to say, if there's no security there to make sure that everyone is disarmed, we're going to let the people with concealed carry permits bring their weapons in the building. Now, the other side of the question is a one-day course on gun safety and the ability to shoot a target that's not moving and not shooting back at you enough to train somebody how to handle an active shooter situation, or you're just going to cause more problems? The other side of it, of course, is that cities could then keep out the guns, but then they have to buy metal detectors, they have to have security guards and the whole routine. This is a bill that actually did get to Governor Jan Brewer twice. She vetoed it twice over the issues of costs and everything else. It's never gone to the current governor, and we don't know how he feels about it.
This week also featured another sort of perennial issue at the Capitol, which is abortion. And there was lawmakers debated something on that as well, right?
There have been several bills on that dealing with fetal tissue research, how long you can do medication abortions, depending on what the FDA says about a drug called RU46. This is a repeat effort of a bid to basically defund Planned Parenthood from the Medicaid program. The bill that passed several years ago said if you provide abortions, you cannot be part of the Medicaid program providing non-abortion services like family planning. And a federal judge, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, said, no, that's not why the federal law reads. That's not the way the Medicaid law reads. They're coming back with a new version of this, which said, unless you segregate out your family planning money from your abortion money and do it to our satisfaction, we're not going to allow you to be a qualified provider. This is in some ways just another roadblock that the abortion foes are trying to throw up in front of Planned Parenthood.
Another bill that the House voted out of the chamber this week was one that would basically unfreeze the kids care program, a health care program for kids in low-income families. Does this bill have any future in the Senate? Like, could this program actually be reinstated, be unfrozen?
I think it could. And here's the issue. Kids care is an extension of Medicaid. Right now, the Arizona Medicaid program covers families up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which I think is somewhere around $27,000 a year. What Kids Care is designed to do is cover the children in those families up to 200% of the federal poverty level, or $40,000 for that same family of three. the federal government has picked up something like 75% of the cost, but that 25% was apparently too much for the state. So in 2010, they froze kids' care enrollment. What's happened is Congress has agreed for any state that restarts it, we will pay for 2016 and 2017, all of it. So there's no cost at all to the state. The concern is, well, what happens at the end of 2017 if Congress doesn't keep the full cost? Well, the bill has a provision that says, we'll just end the program. Well, that's an interesting issue, but it's an interesting political problem. It's one thing to say, well, we're going to let several thousand kids who've just had insurance go without, but it's bad optics. And so I know that the governor has told me that his concern is, what does this mean long term? And I think that's going to be the issue. But this got out with large bipartisan support. And I think the belief is, look, the free money's out there. We'll worry about 2018 and 2018.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. We are recapping the week at the Arizona Legislature. In addition to everything going on at the state capitol, it's been a momentous week in politics overall. The shockwaves from the realization that Donald Trump could be the Republican nominee for president are resonating loudly here in the reliably red Grand Canyon state.
After 2012 GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney blasted Donald Trump as a, quote, phony and a fraud yesterday, the 2008 nominee from Arizona, John McCain, joined him in condemning their party's frontrunner. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, the state's junior senator also has joined the chorus against Trump, but state party leaders are still pledging to support him.
Trump and McCain have a history. Trump went after the former Vietnam prisoner of war as he began his campaign last summer, questioning whether McCain was really a war hero and saying he liked, quote, people who weren't captured. While still pledging to support the party's nominee in a statement yesterday concurring with Romney's speech, McCain shared his concerns about Trump's dishonesty. He cited a growing group of 70 fellow Republican defense and foreign policy leaders who've spoken out against what McCain termed as uninformed and dangerous statements on national security. He strongly urged GOP voters to look past Trump, to think long and hard about who they want to be the next commander-in-chief. Those sentiments were then echoed and expounded upon by the state's number two congressional Republican.
The statements that Donald Trump has made about foreign policy just don't square with reality.
In an interview with KJZZ, Senator Jeff Flake was asked what troubled him the most about Trump's rhetoric.
Well, in particular, the ban on Muslims coming to the U.S., that is not just unconstitutional or wrong-headed. It's the exact opposite of the type of policy we need if we're going to win this war on terrorism.
In addition to his denigration of Muslims, Flake said Trump's policy ideas on Mexico and trade are onerous to partners both here and afar.
It's not a realistic policy to say that we're going to build a wall and force the Mexican government to pay for it. We depend on export to compete globally. If we reject trade deals, including those with Southeast Asian countries and Mexico, that's not good for us.
Still, though, many of the state's most prominent Republicans maintain their support of Trump, including former Governor Jan Brewer, who told Fox News she stands by her man and the choice of voters.
You know, we live in a republic, and the people have marched forward and have been supporting Donald Trump, and in a democracy or a republic, it's the voters that get to decide. And I think it's a little outrageous, to say the least.
Brewer said none of the other GOP candidates, including Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, have done enough to deal with border issues.
I've been talking to those people for the last 6 years, and nobody has done anything. So I think everybody has got the same feelings that I have. We're upset, we're frustrated, we're tired of being ignored. We want somebody to go in there and fight for us. And Donald Trump is a fighter.
Despite the fact the last two Republican nominees for president have now condemned him, the chairman of the Arizona GOP says the state party stands behind the front runner. Speaking from Detroit, where he attended last night's debate, Robert Graham says they'll side with the will of voters.
My job is to make sure that we deliver the state of Arizona for the nominee, whether it be Trump or Cruz or Rubio or Kasich, and that's our mission.
But he admits he's not exactly sure what Trump stands for.
It's tough. He doesn't have a public record as it relates to voting for legislation and things like that. So it would be even difficult to say what kind of Republican he would be.
Graham disputes the contention that his party is fractured and that the nominating system is playing out just the way it should be.
I'm tired of the left media spinning it up to make it sound like it's a fractured element happening right now in the party. It's not.
But Flake believes the great majority of Republican voters feel the same way and are as troubled as he is about a Trump candidacy.
Well, I hope they make another choice. I've not been shy about my feelings toward Donald Trump and his positions. And fortunately, there are other good candidates in the race.
Flake's choice is his Senate colleague, Marco Rubio. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show for Friday, March 4th in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody.
At West Brooklyn Community High School, there is the old and the new coming together in a very familiar ritual. It's Scholastic Aptitude Test season. And while the tests are new this year to address some problems that seem to unfairly favor white suburban kids, the nerves at SAT time are as familiar as the cafeteria chairs Veronica Jersky and Alyssa Bartnick are fidgeting in.
Find a job, or if you want to take a year off, take a year off, or do military. But where I previously came from, it was, no, you're applying to college. You have to apply to college, and that's it. Those are our rules.
That's Alyssa. She and her friend Veronica will both be getting up early to take the SATs this weekend. Veronica knows that to get to college, all roads pass through the SATs.
It's gonna help start my life now. It's so stressful, it's so scary, but you wanna reach the highest score to make yourself look good for these colleges so they can see that, oh, I'm not just a loser or a student from an alternative high school. I'm a student, I'm a good student.
But how will the test judge them, they wonder? Will it be fair? Will their own insecurities make the test harder? Alyssa tries to predict where her weaknesses lie.
The essay is now optional. You have to pay for it. The essay is a lot harder. The question is a lot harder. It's now a rhetorical analysis. So you have to pull out from a text and you have to like completely explain and analyze what the writer's doing. And a lot of kids in high school don't necessarily get to do that in a regular English class.
To get to this point has meant a lot of hard work for both of these girls. And they wonder how that will be reflected, if at all, in their test results. Veronica knows her own trend lines over the past few years are way, way up.
It was like becoming almost a high school dropout to now almost a high school graduate.
In her previous high school, Veronica was fighting all the time. Eventually, the bullying dared her to think she was better than all of this.
It was the worst 2.5 years of my life. It just became a cycle every day. I would come to class, next period I would leave. And nobody would tell me anything. Nobody would say, don't go. Nobody would say, go to class. Nobody would help me understand what I have to do. I want to go to college because I want to prove to my mom and to my family that I'm not the same girl I used to be when I went to John Dewey.
But the feeling of being academic pioneers for both of these young girls is isolating from friends and family. And cheerleading from well-intentioned loved ones only goes so far. In the end, you just have to put down your money and pick up the pencil.
Kind of broke. I didn't know what to do anymore. And I didn't have anybody that had been through the same experiences or anybody who had finished high school or gone to a high school like that or even gone to college to help me out. So it was more like I'm swimming in this big pool with people at the back telling me, well, you can do it. Like, you know where you're going. I know where I'm going. I don't necessarily know how to get there.
These girls both know that even though the test has changed, kids from other families will still have more opportunities for test tutoring and practice. It may not be fair, but Veronica says, bring it on. She and Alyssa will take their chances and are convinced that when a real person eventually gets to meet them, they will see something beyond just a number.
Don't like the SATs. I'm not a good test taker, and I never was. The Board of Education doesn't know their students. They know their students by number. Colleges look at you by number because the SAT basically is a number. You know, I would rather meet face-to-face with the college I dream of going to.
This day and age, there's tons of technology, and even doing like a Skype interview or something like that, I think gives a lot more into who your student is and seeing how they interact and seeing who they are as a person rather than just looking at their test scores.
Alyssa Bartnick is a junior at West Brooklyn Community High School looking to study political science, and Veronica Jersky is a senior who dreams of becoming a dentist. Both are taking the newly redesigned SATs tomorrow.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
It's called a home away from home for the families of military personnel. If you're enlisted or a veteran service member getting medical treatment, a Fisher House is a place where your loved ones can stay so they can be nearby during your time in the hospital. Arizona's first Fisher House opened in Tucson last month, and KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins us with more on the project. So, Jimmy, I think a lot of people have heard of Ronald McDonald Houses. Is this a comparable thing?
Yeah, it is similar to that. The Fisher House Foundation is a nonprofit organization behind these homes. They're usually built on military bases with major hospitals or on VA campuses. There's no fee, and there's no limit to how long the family can stay.
Well, so who do they anticipate is going to use the home in Tucson?
Well, it's on the VA campus in Tucson, so this one will probably be geared more towards veterans' families. Like in many cases, the foundation actually gave the house to the VA after it was built. It's a 16-bedroom house, and about 40 people can stay there comfortably. I talked with Dr. Dana Staggs. He's a chiropractor in Tucson who helped raise money for the project. It cost about $2.5 million, and they got it built in less than a year. So I asked Dr. Staggs to describe the house.
It looks like a five-star hotel is what it looks like. It's beautiful. It's got 16 individual bedrooms. They each have their own bathroom. There's a huge living area, a family room, where a dining room, kitchen, where the families can come in the evenings and they're together because they're going through similar things. So the families spend time together, and a lot of them have lifetime relationships that they make with these other families.
It might seem obvious, but what are the benefits to someone who's going through a medical procedure to be near their loved ones?
You know, being a doctor, I mean, state of mind is everything. And if you have a support there for you, it is a world of difference when you heal. And just in doing this for the last, you know, 2.5+ years that we've been raising money, I've come across many people that have been, you know, injured in combat, and then they just are kind of hanging on, and their family shows up at one of the Fisher houses and able to stay with them, and they just have these near miraculous recoveries. It's amazing when you have your loved ones around how much better you heal.
I imagine for a lot of the military families, the cost of travel normally might be prohibitive.
Well, so many of our military families cannot afford to be gone for a long time or to pay for lodging. So if it's not paid for, they just simply can't make the trip. So with the foundation will actually fly them there. We will continue efforts here, just like they do almost every house, have a local fundraising committee to be able to put food in the house and detergent, you know, for the laundry and little toys for the kids, things like that, so that the families can come and not have to worry about anything financially. Everything will be provided for them. And so that's the beauty of it, is that, you know, so many of our military families live on such a fixed budget, they can't afford to be there when someone is having services done outside of their area.
And Steve, Dr. Staggs says they estimate the house will save families about $500,000 in lodging fees every year.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve.
Picture a courtroom. We think of a judge, a lawyer, the defendant. What about a foreign language interpreter? There are hundreds of them working in our state's courts, and they play a crucial role in ensuring justice for anyone who doesn't speak English. And now the Arizona Supreme Court is making sure our state's court interpreters know the law. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger went inside one criminal courtroom to find out why.
It's the first docket of the morning in Judge Rosa Morales's courtroom at the Maricopa County Superior Court in downtown Phoenix. The judge turns on a static sound as counsel approaches the bench.
This is a criminal judge's morning calendar, so these are all matters that are pending trial.
As the morning gets underway, lawyers come and go, and defendants shuffle through in chains, escorted by guards. Scott Robert Lose approaches the judge alongside a man wearing a striped jail uniform with sheriff's inmate printed on the back. He's an interpreter who's been working in the Superior Court for 37 years.
We are a branch of the court itself. We are a unit within the court.
Lose is one of 100 interpreters employed by the courts across the state to make sure defendants, witnesses, and other courtroom players who don't speak English have the same rights and access to the legal system as anyone else.
We interpret for crime victims. We interpret for next of kin of victims, fact witnesses, petitioners and respondents in family court, in juvenile dependency.
And listening to him interpret the proceedings this morning, it's clear that being an interpreter means much more than speaking the language. His is the voice speaking softly to the defendant, almost simultaneously with the judge and the lawyers.
It is not the interpreter who is talking at all. So it's not my listening to this person and then going over here and giving a summary to somebody else. I have to assume the same tone, what we call the same register, the style and vocabulary of that particular event. So in a courtroom, it's a courtroom register.
Andelo says there's a more important aspect. Court interpreters are dealing with issues of freedom, life, and death.
It is a very tense matter because it's, especially in a criminal case, a question of the freedom of the defendant.
Today, he's interpreting for a defendant in a murder case in which the state is seeking the death penalty. That's why it's important, Lowe says, that interpreters know the complex workings of the court.
No interpreter should walk into a courtroom without understanding the nature of American law, rules of procedure, the code that applies.
The Arizona Supreme Court recently announced it will require all 100 interpreters on staff and the 500 more who are contracted throughout the state to go through a credentialing program by 2019. The goal? To ensure they all meet a baseline of knowledge of not only interpreting skills, but also of the legal concepts and ethics that guide their work.
By the time the matter is ready to go to trial, they should have a good understanding of what the issues are, what the strategies are, the legal doctrine that applies, what it is that's going to happen at trial, who is going to testify, any technical expert testimony that comes in.
Arizona is joining 45 other states that already require credentialing, and Lowe says it's a relief.
We have been seeking it and expecting it for many, many years.
Los is already federally credentialed as an interpreter, but he says he hopes the program in the state will help bring more qualified people into the field and ensure that smaller courts will have qualified interpreters to serve them. Sitting in a vacant attorney-client conference room just outside the courtroom door, waiting to be alerted that his next case has been called, Los explains he's not a social worker.
We always step back from the idea of helping. And so I do believe that there are many, many instances where had the professional interpreter not been present, that the person would not be grasping what they were looking at, what kind of risks they were taking as far as their case.
Mm-hmm. Are you up?
I'm ready on 11.
Great.
All right, number 11.
Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Last month, a story made the rounds about an employee of Yelp who described the challenges she faced living in San Francisco, where the company's located, on her salary. She then lost her job. The company says it was not because of her open letter to Yelp's CEO. In addition, Yelp also announced it was moving some jobs to Arizona, where the cost of living is lower. Chris Camacho, president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, says companies relocate to the Valley for lots of reasons, including costs.
Companies come here because they can access talent, they can do so in an affordable way, and they can go to scale, and we're the next-door neighbor to the largest, one of the largest economies in the world.
Camacho believes the Valley will continue to grow high-wage jobs and says the region's ability to grow should keep cost of living increases at bay. But Bob Grossfeld, with the Arizona AFL-CIO, says he doesn't see a lot of new members moving here because of a lower cost of living.
I don't think we have a lot of union members who would fall into that category. If anything, we're seeing businesses move their operations to Arizona under the umbrella of a lower cost of living, which really translates into they can pay less. And that isn't necessarily something that I think is good for the Arizona economy.
What are some of the problems that you see with that approach as it pertains to the state?
Well, it prevents us from really moving up, from increasing the take-home pay of our workers or families, and kind of keeps us in a suppressed state. The reality is that while on paper the cost of living here is clearly lower than San Francisco, for instance, but not significantly lower than some cities in Texas and in other places across the country. So the whole cost of living equation, I think, is a bit off target.
Bob Grossfeld is a spokesman for the Arizona AFL-CIO. So how common is it for a business to move to a city because it has a lower cost of living? To find out, we turn to David Cooper, senior analyst at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., which focuses on labor issues.
Companies think about three main things whenever they're deciding on where to locate. The first one is just what's the cost and access to sort of key inputs to the business. In manufacturing, it can be access to great power, or in agriculture, great access to a good water supply, or in IT, and access to, you know, fast internet connections and data centers. The second thing is access to suppliers. And finally, the last thing is access to customers. So cost of living is one part of that, but it depends upon where the business is in its life cycle.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that just having a low cost of living and maybe even a lower minimum wage where employers can pay their workers a little less, that in and of itself doesn't do it for businesses in general.
That's right. They have to be able to have access to people that have the right skills for the job. And sure, having lower labor costs may be part of the decision-making process for the business, but other things like the cost of real estate, for example, might be a larger factor. And having low labor costs can in some cases also mean that their workers don't have a lot of money to go out and spend. And again, an important piece of this is having access to customers. And so if people in the local community can't afford to buy the goods and services that you're producing, that may not be a good place to locate your business.
Have you seen it happen where an area has a low cost of living, it attracts a bunch of businesses and a lot of people come in to work there, and then all of a sudden things start happening, the area starts getting developed a little more, and suddenly the cost of living is higher than what it was before? And in some ways, the workers are facing similar problems and the businesses are facing similar problems to maybe what they had before they moved.
Well, the truth is that I think it's important first to take a step back, because the reality is the majority of new job growth actually is homegrown. This phenomenon of businesses moving from one place to another is actually less frequent than I think a lot of folks think. But to get to your point, it is true that the cost of living is primarily driven by housing costs. And what determines where people want to live? Quality of living is determined, you know, can be everything from great schools and, you know, great transportation, great weather, but also access to jobs. So you're right. There is the possibility that when a company starts to locate more of its business in a particular area, if that attracts a lot of workers to want to live in that area, that's going to drive up the demand for housing, which is probably going to lead to those housing costs going up and the cost of living starting to equal out compared to where they may have been located in the first place.
We've heard so much over the past several years about companies outsourcing, especially in manufacturing, to countries where they can pay their workers considerably less.
Yeah.
Have you seen that happening in the U.S.? Are there particular states where companies try to open plants or other facilities where they can just flat out pay their workers less?
It hasn't happened so much in recent years. There was more of that taking place three or four decades ago. There was a greater movement for manufacturing companies to move from relatively higher cost areas in the Northeast and the Midwest down into the South. More recently, that hasn't happened as much. You do hear about some of these high profile cases, companies moving to Texas or Arizona, but that's relatively rare.
David Cooper is a senior analyst at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. The chamber rock band Larkspurs played at the Trunk Space last night along with a few other bands.
The Trunk Space lives up to its name as a tiny music venue on Grand Avenue near Roosevelt Street, as about 150 people can squeeze in at a time, and it's one of the few all-ages venues in town.
Malarkey has been a volunteer with the venue for a few years.
People need music. It shouldn't be something they have to wait till they're 21 for. They should have access to play it and listen to it when they're 5 years old if they want.
Jesse Sergoncic, the guitarist for Larkspurs, says a venue like this helps the bands out too.
They book local acts and national acts, and for local acts, it's often difficult to get into the venues in town, even though there's more than there's ever been.
So for fans and bands alike, it was big news when the owner of the Trunk Space announced they're planning on moving in May. Where to? Well, they're not sure yet. The show's Sarah Ventry spoke with owner Stephanie Carrico, who says that wherever they go, now is the right time for a move.
Trunk Space is 12. I have always thought about it kind of like a person. So when it was one, we didn't let anybody take care of it. It was us all the time. And then as it's gotten older, it's like, oh, well, volunteers can handle it. They can babysit Trunk Space for the night. And now Trunk Space is 12, and I think about it like almost a teenager, that sixth grade, seventh grade, where you're changing so much and you're growing into a teenager to then be an adult. So it just feels like time for it to mature a little. With the nonprofit, I'm hopeful that we can set up a situation where bands always get a certain amount of money when they come and play. Right now, if we split the door, so if five people show up, some band doesn't even have a tank of gas to get to the next city. The other thing with the nonprofit, my hope is that we can help local bands even more. A lot of local bands support touring bands at Trunk Space. And my hope is that we can offer some sort of grant where we could pay for them to record a CD, or we could offer a grant for them to go on tour.
Do you think if Trunk Space restructures to become a nonprofit that it could afford to stay in the space that it's in now? Or is it such a kind of a dire situation that it's important both for the restructuring and to move to a location that's cheaper?
There's other factors to where we don't feel like the space is home anymore. It's just the way the neighborhood has changed, and it just doesn't feel like it really needs us anymore. It feels like we should go somewhere that needs us. It's grown up now. It's not the weird place we moved into 12 years ago. So yeah, with the restructuring, a new space, I think we would be able to afford a little more. But that just seemed like the final push.
I'm also curious how you think Grand Avenue is changing. So you kind of mentioned that the part of Grand Avenue where Trunk Space is getting a little bit fancy. The neighbors are getting frustrated when there are shows and people are parking up the street. Can you sort of describe how you see Grand Avenue changing and maybe what you believe to be the causes of some of those changes?
When Trunk Space moved in 12 years ago, it was a rough part of town, which kept the rents cheap. I mean, artists were the ones who dared to move into that area. And Grand Avenue's been gentrified. It's gotten much fancier, and you know, we got the fancy bike lanes, and rents are going up, and some of the older spaces are feeling that crunch. I think that Grand's moving in a really interesting way. I think it's going to be a bustling destination for sure. Hopefully some more restaurants will move in, and it can really be a walkable street. I don't think Phoenix has a lot of walkable streets, but Trunk Space can exist in an area that isn't as fancy, I guess.
That's Stephanie Carrico, owner of the Trunk Space, talking to the show's Sarah Ventry.
When we think of people who helped develop the Valley, we often think of pioneers who came from the East Coast or the Midwest. But one of them is from Japan. His greatest contribution is founding one of Arizona's biggest companies. Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez tells us the story.
We turn on a switch, press a button, or click a remote control. And that quickly, electricity is running. Arizona has electricity today in large part because of a Japanese immigrant. Did you know the Arizona Power Service Company was founded by Hachiro Onuki?
He brought electrical lighting to Phoenix.
Karen Leong is an associate professor at Arizona State University School of Social Transformation. She has been researching Onuki's life in the U.S.
He was one of the founders with other men in Arizona of the Arizona Power Service, the APS. It was called the Phoenix Illuminating Company.
Hachiro Onuki came to the U.S. in 1876. He traveled here with a group of American sailors that was bringing Japanese items to the Philadelphia Centennial Expo. He was supposed to help transport the items, then make his way west to San Francisco to take a ship back. By the mid-1880s, while headed west, Onuki made his way to Arizona.
He started a silver mine that I don't think did very well. He changed his Japanese name to almost what sounds like some sort of Nordic name with Onik, and really made a life for himself.
The now named Hutchlin Onick befriended a couple of businessmen. They joined into a partnership on a new venture, gas and electricity. The men decided the best place to launch their business was the growing town of Phoenix.
I don't think he personally knew a lot about electricity, but I think he was willing to invest and get other people with him to invest in this idea of electricity.
And that he did. As the company builder and superintendent, he introduced the Phoenix Illuminating Gas and Electric Company franchise to the Phoenix City Council. By April 1886, the city council gave their support. The company began providing power to local businesses, and by early 1887, the first city lamp was lighted on the corner of Washington Street and what we know today as Central Avenue. The company continued to evolve, and after several years, Onick relinquished his leadership.
He eventually moved to Seattle, and that's where we sort of lose sight of him.
APS has written a book about the company's history, and it begins with the story of its founder, Hachiro Onuki. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
Arizona is the 27th most religious state in the country, according to a new report from the Pew Research Center. The group looked at criteria including how many residents said religion is very important in their lives, how many attend worship services at least weekly, and how many pray daily. Arizona's ranking of 53% of adults who are highly religious puts the state in a tie with Michigan, Pennsylvania, D.C., and North Dakota. For more on the report, I'm joined by Greg Smith, Associate Director for Religion Research at Pew. Greg, what were you trying to figure out?
Well, what we did is we tried to identify some indicators of religiousness, of religiosity, that are as broadly applicable in the general population as was possible, at least in the American context. Most Americans are Christians. Most of those who are not Christians say they have no particular religion. And so we tried to look for indicators of religiosity for those big, broad groups. So we took those measures and we sort of put them all together to develop a scale, an overall scale of religiousness. And then what we did is we took that scale and we compared the states to each other. And when you do that and you look specifically at Arizona, you see that it comes out about in the middle of the pack.
Is there anything that you can extrapolate from these numbers? I mean, is there anything that, for example, Arizona's ranking among the states in this report says about Arizona other than how religious its residents say they are?
Well, you know, one of the things that I like to look at with respect to states is not just how religious they are, but what's the religious makeup of the state? What sorts of religious groups are represented in the state? And one of the things that's really interesting about Arizona is that the religious profile, the religious composition of Arizona looks very much like the country as a whole. The two largest religious groups in Arizona are evangelical Protestants, and those who say they have no religion. That's very much what we see in the public as a whole. The next largest group is Catholics. 21% of Arizonans identify as Catholic. Again, very similar to what we see among the public as a whole. A couple of interesting differences, a couple of things that are unique about Arizona. There are far fewer members of historically black Protestant denominations than we see among the public as a whole, and there are more Mormons in Arizona than there are in the overall U.S. population.
Religion is a very personal kind of thing, and people, you know, have their own practices and they have their own beliefs. When you're doing a study like this, which is self-reporting, do you have to account for maybe some people who are responding aspirationally as opposed to what they actually do?
Well, I think you have to be careful in how you interpret the data. I think that one of the things we have to keep in mind when we ask people about their religion is, especially when we ask them about their religious practices, I think we have to keep in mind that people are often telling us as much about their religious identity as they might be about the details of how often they might do this or that religious thing. So when people tell us, for example, that they attend religious services at least once a week, I think the way we should interpret that is that they are the kind of person, they think of themselves as the kind of person who attends religious services regularly. It's not to say that they never miss a week. Same thing when people tell us that they pray every day.
Do you have a sense of how the numbers that you have here relate to maybe what you have found in the past? I mean, do you have a sense of if Arizona is getting more religious, is roughly the same amount of religiousness as it has been in the past?
Well, you know, when we look at the country as a whole, what we're seeing is we're beginning to see signs that the U.S. population as a whole is becoming somewhat less religious, by a modest amount, gradually, but becoming somewhat less religious nonetheless. And possibly the best indicator of that, the most prominent indicator of that, is that the share of Americans who say they have no religious identity, the share of Americans who says they identify as atheist or as agnostic or as having no religion in particular, that number is growing quite rapidly. In our most recent study, we find that about 23% of American adults say they have no religious affiliation. That's up 7 points in just 7 years. We see that same trend reflected in the data for Arizona. In 2014, 27% of Arizonans tell us they were religiously unaffiliated. That's up about 5 points since we last did a study like this in 2007.
Greg Smith is Associate Director for Religion Research at the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. We are talking about Pew's How Religious Is Your State study. Greg, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hitting a baseball has been called the most difficult thing to do in sports. It's even harder when almost nobody has any idea where a pitch is going.
Wow, did you see the hop on that ball? That's a regular dipsy-doo you got there, Professor. How'd you do it?
The result of a great deal of scientific research.
The knuckleball fits that description very well, and it's why so few pitchers in the history of Major League Baseball have mastered how to throw it. Of active knuckleballers, only Ari Dickey of the Toronto Blue Jays has a regular Major League gig. But the knuckler can also extend careers because it puts much less torque and pressure on the arm. Arizona Diamondbacks broadcaster Tom Candiotti was a master of the knuckler, winning 151 Major League games. Tom, why don't more pitchers throw it? Is there a feeling in the clubhouse that you're not a tough guy if you're not focused on throwing 95-mile-an-hour fastballs?
Well, it's kind of strange. You know, you talk about this game today, on the pitching side of it, it's such a high-velocity game. You know, you're so worried about the velocity and guys that can just bring it and miss bats and stuff. When I was coming up, it was more of a game hitting guys out and winning the game and trying to outpitch the guy you're pitched against.
Yeah.
You know, it was whether you got ground balls or pop-ups or, you know, strikeouts, whatever it was, you know, you wanted to pitch one, at least one out longer than the guy you're pitching against and outpitch him.
Does it surprise you more guys don't want to experiment considering it might lengthen their career?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of guys actually kind of do experiment with it, but it's a hard pitch to throw. It's just not easy. And especially given in this day and age now where the focus really is on not how many innings you can pitch, but, you know, how hard you can throw and get through that lineup a couple times and hand off to the bullpen who probably comes in throwing a little harder than the starter. But I hope they don't phase that pitch out, because if you didn't know a guy was a knuckleball pitcher, at the end of the year, you just look down at the stats and you compared him with another guy that was a pretty successful pitcher. The stats all look about the same. You know, hey, this guy's got 15 wins. He's got, hey, 230 innings pitched. And, you know, he's got 180 strikeouts and da-da-da-da-da. And then all of a sudden, you know, you take the little card off the guy's name and you go, oh, well, that guy's a knuckleballer. It's kind of working against you. There's a lot of general managers that are going to have to understand that, you know, it's kind of a different breed, and managers have to understand how to coach a guy like that. And you have to have a catcher that's willing to handle it.
Are the guys who've been successful as knuckleballers guys who are really, do they study the game in a different way than other pitchers do?
Really, the concept of pitching is the same, you know, for a conventional pitcher. And, you know, the things that you can control as a knuckleballer really are taking a spin off the ball and, you know, hitting the catcher in the glove. But what it does to hitters, they want to recognize the pitch. And so when you don't see the spin on the ball, you can't pick up the rotation. You don't know if it's going to be a slider, a curveball, a fastball, whatever. It's the knuckleball. And they don't see the spin because there is no spin. And so it becomes, it can upset timing real easy.
Former knuckleballer and current Diamondbacks announcer Tom Candiotti. So what makes the knuckleball move the way it does in sometimes inexplicable ways? I'm now joined by Ricardo Valerdi, professor of systems engineering at the U of A and developer of the Science of Baseball program for a number of major league organizations. Ricardo, what is a successful knuckleballer doing to the ball?
What you see them accomplish is add randomness to the pitch. And that's essentially why the knuckleball is effective, because batters are trying to predict where the ball is going to go, and they're used to seeing a fastball or a slider. And that's easier to predict because It's what they have, what I call constant trajectory. But the knuckleball does not have constant trajectory. So that's what makes it much more difficult to hit and to predict. And it's much more susceptible to the elements. So there's a little bit of side wind. The fact that the knuckleball is moving slower and it's not spinning makes it more subjected to wind or any other element.
I think what some hitters also would say, the pitchers aren't always sure where it's going to go either.
Yeah, it's actually the catchers that are guessing as well. So you'll see some catchers miss occasionally. There's a Gary Bennett, who was the catcher for the St. Louis Cardinals in 2006 when they won the World Series. He told me that the best way to catch a knuckleball is to wait until it hits the backstop and get up and pick it up off the ground.
U of A systems engineering professor and baseball scientist Ricardo Valerdi with some insights on the knuckleball. Now, if you want to know what the knuckler grip is like, you want to dig your index and middle fingernails into one of the seams on the baseball. And remember, you're trying to take the spin off the ball and then just let it fly. I mean, at least once you're outside, you don't want to break any windows because you can't really be sure how the knuckler is going to move. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.